Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gygax, and I have good news for you. I started reading the ELM on my own, and it's not going to be appropriate for reading all the way through, straight through, because most of it is irrelevant. It talks about how management should treat other management, and how the post office is supposed to be set up, and all that stuff. So, I am reading it all the way through, because I'm a team player. And I'm here to help you guys. And so that is my burden. And I carry it heavily. But that's all right, because what I'm doing while I'm reading it is I'm copying and pasting into a Google Doc all the relevant sections or the stuff that I want to talk to you guys about. So I'm going to err on the side of being thorough and giving you, if I'm not sure whether to include it or not, I'm just going to include it. Because whatever's in there that might be boring, dude, it's never going to be as bad as like reading through the contract. Oh, and on that note, I've been listening back to episodes where I read the contract for its intended purpose, because I need to refresh myself on certain parts of the contract. You know, I was curious about some stuff that was in Article 7, I think it was, and so I just found my episode with Article 7 and listened to it. And you know what was in that episode? My good friend, the Southern Gentleman, was in that episode. And, dude, the cringe of listening back to that. And thank all of you who wrote in saying, hey, man, just drop the accents. Because, oh, dude, I know at some point I'm going to re-listen to the time when I attempted a Nigerian accent and it came off as like a Jamaican vampire or something. Which I still contend is the exact Nigerian dialect of a particular region. You just don't know what that region is, and that's on you, not on me. But anyway, all of that is neither here nor there. One more thing, actually, before we get into the meat, and that is I was on the radio recently, KNPR in Nevada. I'm an avid hiker in my spare time, and so I go on there from time to time to talk about hiking. And after the episode was over, I talked to the audio producer about what he uses or what he might recommend to get rid of like the low-end noise, like the breathing noise, for example, of me taking my breaths. And he recommended Adobe Audition, which is available on the cloud, which is great because I only have a Chromebook, and so I don't need to download a bunch of fancy software. It can all be done on the cloud. But it is $23 a month, and I don't know. I don't know if it's worth it. I think you guys might have to put up with breathing noises for a while. And tough luck. Unless somebody wants to front the money and pay for it. And then I got to figure out how to use it on top of that, which is probably the biggest barrier. So anyway, with I've already wasted 3 minutes. So let's get into the ELM. I'm going to read through as much as I can. In my first sitting, I got all the way through up into the low 400s. I don't think I'm going to get that far today in my notes, but I'm never going to get anywhere if I don't get started. So we'll start out with 125.1, which is an overview of the post office organization in general. And it reads, once an effective structure is established, the next step in the organizational design process is to identify appropriate staffing levels. Based on operational factors, staffing requirements, numbers, types, and grade levels of positions may differ from organizations with the same structure. However, functional responsibilities and reporting relationships remain generally consistent from one installation to the next. So here, it talks about the requirement to have appropriate staffing levels, and this is a problem system-wide across the post office. So if you want to put pressure on management, this is laid out right in the ELM, that this is one of their obligations, is to staff appropriately. And if you're going to cite that there are all these problems that are related to staffing, this is one of the citations that I think you could reasonably make, is right here in 125.1. Because it says you need appropriate staffing levels. All right, that was the only thing that was useful out of the 100s, because again, it was all just organizational structure to the post office. So next is, 212.1. Chief Human Resources Officer and Executive Vice President, that's the title, and then this is their role. The Chief Human Resources Officer and Executive Vice vice president is responsible for ensuring that each position in the Postal Service is evaluated and assigned to an appropriate grade level. Postal Service employees receive equal pay for substantially equal work. So this is all covered in our collective bargaining agreement, and what we get paid is laid out there. But I hope that our union, when they're negotiating our new contract, points to provisions like this and says, look, these are the duties that we now have. These are the duties we now have, and we should be paid appropriately because we're doing this similar work, and so we should get paid similar to this grade level. Or we're doing like this job plus that job, so we should get paid like what those jobs are together. So that's 212.1. Next, we move on to 230. Bargaining unit positions covered by a national agreement. And 231 is job descriptions. PS Form 820, Ranking of Position Request, is the basic document used to describe and evaluate or rank bargaining unit jobs covered by a collective bargaining unit agreement, and generates the following two types of job descriptions. Key positions, used as benchmarks or models in the creation of standard positions. Key positions are ranked to clearly reflect level distinctions. Key positions use general terms to describe the duties and responsibilities of more than one employee. Standard positions. Although standard positions are described in more specific terms than key positions, they also use general terms to describe the duties and responsibilities of more than one employee. The purpose of a job description is to describe three components of a position: primary assignment or basic function, tasks and duties involved in carrying out the primary assignment, and organizational relationship. Oh, and the third one, organizational relationship. These components constitute the basis for comparing a position with key positions and for aligning it with other positions in the Postal Service. So, I mention this one because it's useful for determining what our job description actually is. It references in here a form, which I skipped over. Oh, no, I said it. It's PS Form 820 that should have our official job description. So if you're trying to figure out, like, is this in my job description or not? Am I actually supposed to be doing this? That Form 820 would be a key piece of evidence in making your argument. All right, moving on. 233, evaluating bargaining unit positions. Purpose. 233.1 purpose. Evaluating bargaining unit positions consists of establishing a clear understanding of the duties, responsibilities, and work requirements of a position. Careful description of the position ensures that employees receive equal pay for substantively equal work. And there it is again, right? If we're doing equal work to somebody in this higher position, then we should be getting that pay. 233.2, basis for position evaluation. The comparison of a position's duties, responsibilities, and work requirements to key job descriptions serves as the only basis for evaluation. A. The following factors determine final ranking. 1. Difficulty of the work to be performed. 2. Degree of responsibility to be exercised. 3. Scope and variety of tasks involved. 4. Conditions under which the work is performed. So, these are the factors that go into determining our pay. And again, a competent union is going to be using these to argue, look at the difficulty of our work compared to, say, what a clerk does. Indoors all day, in reliable conditions, they have ergonomic equipment to help them out, things like that. Which is not to say that a clerk's job isn't difficult, but I think it's fair to argue that a carrier's job is more difficult. The degree of responsibility. We're out there independently. We have to be responsible for all of the money. We have to be responsible for interactions with the public. You know, all of these things put us on this higher level than a lot of other craft jobs at the post office. Scope and variety of tasks involved. I mean, there's a huge variety of things that we do. You know, we work on the street and in the office. We deal with supervision. We deal with customers. We deal with dogs. We have to know how to drive. We have all these different things that we have to do. And then 4, conditions under which the work is performed. There are no worse conditions than what are dealt with by city letter carriers. Rural carriers probably also, except that they're in their vehicle most of the time. So these are factors that I hope our union is using, I'm sure they are, to fight for better wages. All right, and then B, the following factors do not affect the final ranking. One, the incumbent's knowledge, skills, abilities, or previous position title. Two, the designation of the hiring list or the maintenance craft's internal promotion eligibility register or preferred assignment register is applicable, from which the employee will be selected. So that's where we get back into. This is more about the management side, right? This is a management tool or a management handbook, the Employee Labor Relations Manual, but these things are still relevant because this is the basic process by which the post office determines how much it's going to pay people. All right, 234, appeals. Employees with positions covered by a collective bargaining agreement may grieve the salary level, title, or identification of their positions through the agreement's grievance arbitration procedure. So here we have a craft employee like you and me. We can grieve these issues. I have no idea when this would come up, but it's good to know that at least it's specified that we have these rights. So I figured I might as well at least tell you about them. And that's it for the 200s. Now we get to the 300s, which is more interesting. 311.11, best qualified personnel. Employee resource management designs employment and placement processes to ensure that the recruitment, assignment, promotion, motivation, training, development, and retention procedures yield the best qualified personnel to carry out the mission of the Postal Service with maximum productivity and economy of operations. All right, so that's a lot of stuff that says we want these, we want to make sure we get the best people. And I'm going to read this again, and I want you to think about this time that this is how your supervisors, your managers, your postmaster, this is how they all got selected. They are the best qualified personnel. So I'll read it again. Employee resource management, that's the HR essentially, designs employment and placement processes that designs the way we get these people to ensure that the recruitment, assignment, promotion, motivation, training, development, and retention procedures yield the best qualified personnel to carry out the mission of the Postal Service. Is your supervisor the best qualified personnel? I think this process needs some revisiting. All right, next, 311.13, prohibition of political recommendations. The law, 39 U.S.C. 1002, prohibits political and certain other recommendations for appointments, promotions, assignments, transfers, or designations of persons in the Postal Service. So this is a throwback to a time when the postmaster position was determined strictly by cronyism, by political cronyism. It was a federal appointment, and back in like the 1800s, this was one of the ways that people got elected to president, is when they would get elected, they would go through and name new postmasters. And it was a great privilege to be designated as a postmaster, because in many cases, your store became the new post office. And so anybody who wanted to get their mail had to come into your store, and suddenly your store or your building is the center of the town. And that brings a lot of opportunities with it. So the person running for president would say, hey, if you can, you know, gin up support in your county, I will make sure that you are the next postmaster. So now we have laws that directly prohibit that sort of thing. Does cronyism still exist within management? Probably. You know, people are still going to try to work with the folks they already know. If you know of specific examples of cronyism, this is something that you could cite to try to undermine that. Does cronyism still happen within our union? Well, it's not, this law I don't think applies directly to our union, but cronyism is still a problem, and it absolutely exists within our union. When I got fired from the Carrier Academy, you know, people who responded to me and talked to me about it, and you know, I also have the concern of being removed arbitrarily as a union steward because I'm only appointed to my position. And people around the country were like, yeah, that happens all the time. In my branch, when the new president got elected, anybody who ran against him was suddenly removed as a union steward. And it was talked about like yeah, it's fucked up, but it's normal. And dude, what the fuck are we doing? Like, how could that be acceptable to anyone with any kind of integrity? Dude. So, I mean, I would love to make a proposal for a bylaw within my local union that would say, like, hey, if you want to unappoint somebody, it's got to be with cause. But given the thin ice I'm already on, that proposal is probably going to have to wait. So anyway, it is prohibited for to have political recommendations in management. All right, or in the post office in general. 321.1, anticipating recruitment needs. Generally, non-bargaining positions, that would be like management and like technical support and things like that, are filled from within the Postal Service. When vacancies are not filled by internal placement of employees, career and non-career vacancies may be filled externally. So I long wondered, how do people get these other jobs at the post office? Like answering the phone, working in human resources, being the IT guy, you know, all these different jobs. Like, how does that happen? Somebody works in advertising for the post office. How do you get a gig like that? Well, it turns out that these are recruited from within the post office. And the next provision, 321.2, talks about how you're supposed to hear about it. Publicizing job opportunities, 321.2. District human resources managers and appointing officials must ensure that job opportunities are widely publicized to recruit new employees. And I'll point out here, it uses the word must. They must ensure that job opportunities are widely publicized. So if you don't see these open positions being advertised and you're interested in it, ask about it, because they should be letting as many people as possible know that, hey, we're looking for a new guy to debug our latest mainframe, or who knows what jobs they do, right? But this is how this process is supposed to work. Next, we're going to talk about what happens if you get fired from the post office. Then can you come back to the post office? And that is covered in section 343, applicants separated for cause. If you're going to get rehired, prior approval of the manager of human resources at the district level, the manager of human resources at the area level, or the vice president of employee resource management for headquarters and headquarters field unit positions. You must get prior approval from these people. Prior approval must be obtained before employing any formal postal or federal employee who was removed from the Postal Service or other federal employment for cause, which means like you were fired. They got rid of you for a reason. Or who resigned after being notified that charges proposing removal would be or had been issued. See Handbook EL 312 514.11, Handling Removals from Postal Service or Other Federal Employment, for further information. So yeah, if you got fired, or you know somebody who maybe wants to come back from the post office, and they got fired from the post office, or fired from the Internal Revenue Service, or fired from the Bureau of Land Management, or anywhere else in the federal government, it's going to be a process getting back in. And a lot of people have to say that it's okay for you to come back in. That seems like a pretty high hill to climb. All right, next, if you are wondering whether you can have a second job, here is the official word on whether you can have a separate job in private industry. There's separate rules if you want to have a separate federal job, and I'm not going to get into those. I didn't bother copying those. But if you want to work, you know, on the side, like my station, in this whole installation in Las Vegas, we have the problem of we've grossly overhired CCAs. And so they're doing side gigs while they wait for the hours to pick back up, you know, Uber Eats or driving for Lyft or whatever. So here's the rule on that, 348.3. A Postal Service employee may be employed concurrently as an employee in the private sector, unless such employment has an adverse impact on postal operations or where conflicts of interest may be generated between the private employer and or employee and the Postal Service. Like, for example, if you get a side job working for FedEx, you know, that could be seen as a conflict of interest. When a postal employee is employed concurrently by another private employer, postal employment is primary and takes precedence when a scheduling conflict arises. See 662.1 for further information. I'm sure we'll get to 662 at some point. So yes, you can have another job. It is not prohibited, but there are these restrictions in place that it can't conflict with what you're doing in the post office, and that includes scheduling, according to the ELM. 351.12, filling postal positions. The assignment, reassignment, or promotion of postal employees fills most postal positions except entry-level positions. So this again speaks to how all of these internal positions are filled, how we get postmasters, how we get the IT guy, how we get whatever. You know, this reiterates that we hire, we promote, and we hire from within as much as possible. Next, 351.13, eligibility for promotion. An employee serving under a career appointment is eligible for reassignment or promotion to a career position. An employee serving under a non-career appointment is not eligible for promotion to a career position. So I find this interesting because don't we have CCAs who have become supervisors? I feel like that would be going from a non-career appointment and being promoted to a career position. I imagine the supervisory role to be a career position. Maybe I'm mistaken. I don't know. Is a supervisor a career position? Is the CCA going from non-career to career? Or maybe for some reason it's not considered an appointment. I know from having read ahead that what's not considered a promotion. From reading ahead, we're going to learn a little bit more about what they consider to be a promotion. And, dude, I'm not going to fill out this chart they use to figure out whether it's a promotion or not, but it certainly seems like this would qualify as a promotion. And how can that be? How can you have somebody go from it says an employee serving under a non-career appointment is not eligible for promotion to a career position. I don't know, like, how does that not cover CCAs becoming supervisors? I don't know. If you know, feel free to reach out to me, classesofmail@gmail.com. Next, 351.6, mutual exchanges. So we have our own policy in the contract that covers mutual exchanges where, you know, I work in Las Vegas, I want to move to Billings, Montana, and I find somebody in Billings, Montana who wants to move to Las Vegas, and so we just exchange. And it's all laid out in the contract how that works, and it's also laid out in the ELM. So I'm going to read the provision in the ELM, and I'll just tell you in advance, it essentially says the same thing it says in the contract. Career employees may exchange positions subject to the provisions of the appropriate collective bargaining agreement if the officials in charge at the installations involved approve the exchange of positions. Mutual exchanges must be made between employees in positions at the same grade levels. The following employees are not permitted to exchange positions. A. Part-time flexible employees with full-time employees. B. Bargaining employees with non-bargaining employees. And C. Non-supervisory employees with supervisory employees. So again, this is essentially the same thing that it says in the contract. If you want to swap with somebody, both of the installation heads have to agree, and then you swap as long as you're in the same position. All right, 353.1, promotion. So here we get to the definition of promotion as discussed earlier. A promotion is the permanent assignment with or without relocation of an employee, A, to a position having a higher grade than the position to which the employee is currently assigned, or B, to a position with a higher equivalent grade. So maybe using these criteria, if you are an entry-level supervisor, then it wouldn't be considered a promotion because you're currently an entry-level carrier, and now you're an entry-level supervisor. I don't know. I don't know how this works. It happens, right? CCAs get promoted to supervisor, so somebody has probably looked into this, but that's what it says in the in the ELM about promotions. All right, next, 355, light duty assignments. 355.1, voluntary requests, and 355.11, circumstances. any full-time, regular, or part-time flexible employee recuperating from a serious illness or injury and temporarily unable to perform the assigned duties may voluntarily submit a written request to the installation head for temporary assignment to a light-duty assignment. So, if you are injured, if you get really sick on the job or off, you can request in writing a light-duty assignment. Any ill or injured full-time, regular, or part-time flexible employee having a minimum of 5 years of postal service, or any full-time, regular, or part-time flexible employee who sustained an injury on duty while performing the assigned duties, regardless of years of service, can submit a voluntary request to the installation head for permanent reassignment to light-duty assignment. So, if you get injured on the job, you put in a request that you want to be moved to light-duty. Or if you have been with the post office at least 5 years, same process. You put in a written request that you want to be on light duty. 355.12, method. Voluntary requests are made in accordance with the applicable collective bargaining agreement. And yes, this is covered in our contract. Now we get to the important part. 355.13, response. The light duty provisions of the various collective bargaining agreements between the Postal Service and the postal unions require that the installation heads show the greatest consideration for full-time, regular, or part-time flexible employees requiring light duty or other assignments, giving each request careful attention and reassign such employees to the extent possible in the employee's office. So, they can't just say, oh no, we don't have anything. And this is the exact same thing it says in the contract, right? They have to show the greatest consideration, that they really have to look to try to find you light duty work. 355.14, no guarantee. The light duty provisions of the various collective bargaining agreements between the U.S. Postal Service and the postal unions do not guarantee any employee who is on a light duty assignment any number of hours of work per day or per week. And again, this is what's in our contract. So these provisions, not only do they mirror what's in the contract, they strengthen what's in our contract because it's reflected here. Now it turns one citation into two citations. Not only did we fight for this, but management's handbook, that's like across crafts, says the same thing. All right, and then we get to 362.2. When a change to lower level may be made. So this generally is going to apply to people in supervisory positions. Like maybe somebody is a postmaster in, let's say Palmdale, California. I lived there for a while. It was not fantastic. Maybe it's great now. It was a long time ago that I lived in Palmdale. Anyway, they're a postmaster there, and that's nice. That's a good gig, but they don't want to live in Palmdale anymore. So they could move to where's better than Palmdale? Lancaster. They could move to Lancaster if they just took a position as a station manager. So they could put in a request to be moved to a lower level. And 362.21 talks about how this is handled at the request of the employee. In theory, I guess a full-time regular could request to be a PTF. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but I don't know. Maybe somebody would at some point. So here's the rule. Employees may be changed to a position of lower grade level at their own request, without regard to adverse action procedures, when their written requests establish that the changes are made solely for personal reasons in their own interests. Employees' written requests become a part of their official personnel folders. The request must contain the following facts. Employee and not the postal official initiated the request for the action. Postal official or any superior has not pressured the employee. Employee fully understands the requested transaction and considers the reduction to be in his or her self-interest and benefit. So, there you go. You can voluntarily request to be demoted if you meet these criteria. If it's for, like, you have a good reason for wanting to take this step down. But it turns out in the very next provision, you can be demoted against your will because of performance. 362.22, because of performance. When an employee's performance is unsatisfactory due to the employee's inability to do the work, a change to a lower grade may be made to a position where the employee can reasonably be expected to adequately perform. A written notice prepared in compliance with the adverse action procedure precedes this change. So, here's evidence that bad supervisors, bad managers, bad postmasters can and should be demoted. It is not off the table. It is specifically put on the table in 362.22. Next, 364, changes in duty status. Oh, dude, I had a big breakfast and it changed my duty status. All right, anyway, changes in duty status are changes that place employees in a non-pay status or return them to active duty and pay status. These changes are defined in this section below. The one I want to talk about is leave without pay. Leave without pay, or LWOP, is a temporary non-pay status and absence from duty granted when appropriate as a result of an employee's request. And this includes time spent on active military duty. So this is the provision that lets you request LWOP if for some reason you want that. Maybe you know you're running low on sick leave, you want to save it, you want to save your vacation days for when you actually want to go on vacation, so I'm willing to not get paid for a couple of days so that I can still take my vacation later in the summer or whatever. Then you put in your request for LWOP. It is something that is requested by you. It is employee initiated. And it is granted, it says, when appropriate. So who determines what's appropriate? Well, probably a supervisor. But they can't, or at least they shouldn't, arbitrarily deny your request, right? They should have a reason if they say, no, you can't take leave without pay. So this is where it comes from. That is in the ELM 364. Next, we're going to talk about getting fired. So first, or leaving the post office, because first we're going to talk about voluntary separations, which are 365.2, and 365.21 covers resignations. And here we have 365.211, the definition of a resignation. Resignation is a separation at the employee's discretion. Resignations must be accepted and are binding once submitted. However, employees are permitted to withdraw their resignation request, provided the request to withdraw is made before the close of business on the effective date of the resignation. So there you go. You can resign. And if you change your mind before your resignation is effective, you can change your mind. But it says here resignations must be accepted. And, of course, what other option does the post office has? Hey, I'm quitting. No, you can't quit. Like, dude, give me a break. This is a voluntary job. So that's that. 365.212, resignations could be to avoid separation for cause. So I'm going to resign to avoid getting fired. Here's what it says about that. If an employee submits a resignation after having been notified, either orally or in writing, that an adverse action has been proposed for removal, change to a lower grade, or suspension for reasons furnished him or her, the resignation must be accepted. A resignation must also be accepted if an employee receives a written notice of decision to separate the employee for reasons given in a notice of decision. All right, so that's that provision. And I want to point out that earlier when we were talking about getting rehired, it had a category of if you've been fired from a federal job, it also has a provision for if you quit a federal job because you were going to get fired. So this is probably not a get-out-of-jail-free card where you can just resign and then everything's hunky-dory. All you're really doing is probably waiving your rights to unemployment insurance. Although I don't really know how unemployment insurance works, and I hope I never find out. It's one of the benefits, at least in theory, of working at the post office, is it's very difficult to get fired. All right, next, what does management do with the resignation? 365.215, notice and acceptance. The following policies apply regarding notice and acceptance of resignations. A, written resignation. Resignation should be submitted in writing. The employee specifies the reason and effective date. When possible, written notices of resignation must be given at least 2 weeks before the anticipated last day of work. All right, so when possible, the notice must be given 2 weeks. It's not always possible, and that's for you to decide. B, oral resignation. if the employee declines to submit written resignations, their oral resignation must be accepted, preferably in the presence of witnesses. The supervisor or other official who receives an oral resignation records the date received, the reason given, the effective date, and the names of any witnesses. This record, signed by the supervisor, is placed in the employee's official personnel folder as a permanent record. So when you say, "Oh, screw you guys, I'm out of here, I quit," well, supervisor can then put you down as giving an oral resignation. And why did you quit? I don't know, because you're a quitter. And that's it. You're out. So you can fire or you can quit. You know, I bet there are people in the post office who have quit out of anger and then tried to put that genie back in the bottle, and that is, or put that toothpaste back in the tube, and that is not very easy to do. C, reason for resignation. The reason for a resignation should be clearly stated in either a written or oral resignation. If the employee fails to give a reason for resignation, the supervisor enters the reason she or he believes the employee resigned. See 365.214 when the reason for resignation is to perform military service. So if you don't give them a reason, they just get to put whatever reason they feel like. And D, effective date. When the employee sets an effective date of resignation to include a period of unapproved leave, the unauthorized absence may be charged to either earned annual leave or leave without pay at the discretion of the appointing official. The employee is informed of the decision and given an opportunity to change the effective date. If the employee is resigning in lieu of an involuntary separation, in lieu of getting fired, he or she may not set an effective date for resignation that will occur after the effective date for the involuntary separation. Oh, that's too bad. That would have been really convenient. No, you can't fire me. I quit 9 years from now. All right. 365.3, separations involuntary. 365.31, removal. 365.311, definition. Removal is an action involuntarily separating an employee other than an employee serving under a temporary appointment or a career employee who has not completed the applicable probationary period for cause. So removal is when they get rid of you for a reason. You did something wrong and you're out. Or whatever their reason is, and you're out, right? That's for cause. And that's what the union will probably argue over, is what is the cause and is it a just cause? 365.312, effective date. The effective date is the date designated by the official making the decision, but is not before the expiration of the required time limit for the notice period. So in the contract, that says that separation should have a 30-day notice. I don't know exactly how all of that works, but that's kind of the thing that it's talking about here. There's a time limit for the notice period. 365.32, separation for disqualification. 365.321, applicability. This type of separation applies only to employees who have not completed their probationary period. So here it's going to talk about what happens when they fire a CCA who's still on probation. 365.322, or I guess PTFs. Now, if you get hired straight into a PTF, you have a probation for that too. So this is what happens if you get fired while you're still on probation. 365.322, reasons for action. Separation by disqualification is an action that results from the failure to meet conditions specified at the time of appointment, such as failure to qualify by conduct or capacity during the probationary period. It may also result from information that, if known at the time of appointment, would have disqualified the employee for the appointment. So the second part is pretty straightforward. Like, if you lied on your application, maybe you said you were a U.S. citizen when you're not, or you said you don't have any felonies when you do, things like that could get you fired once they find out about them. But this other part, you know, I don't know how the union fights CCA removals during probation, but it looks like they can't just fire you willy-nilly for no reason, right? Because it says here that it results from the failure to meet conditions specified at the time of appointment, such as failure to qualify by conduct or capacity. So the capacity part or even the conduct part should be demonstrable by management, and I feel like this would be an avenue for grievance. You know, management tries to make it seem like they can just get rid of you at any time for any reason, but right here in their own ELM, it talks about what the reasons are. All right, 365.323, probationary period. Separation by disqualification must be effected during the probationary period. Action is initiated at any time in the probationary period when it becomes apparent that the employee lacks capacity for efficient service. So that's the standard that management's going to have to meet, is do you have the capacity for efficient service? And this is what, you know, it's all about. You have to go faster, faster, faster. 365.324, who initiates action? Supervisors may recommend separation by disqualification, but such recommendations must be referred for decision to the official having authority to take the action. So apparently supervisors don't have that authority. I don't know who does, maybe the station manager, certainly a postmaster, I would imagine, but I don't know. You know, and this is something that hopefully the union officials who are fighting this sort of thing, they do know. You know, and I want to go back to the cause. When it becomes apparent that the employee lacks capacity for efficient service, you know, that's subjective. Who determines whether or not it's apparent that they lack the capacity? And I feel like that's something that can be argued. And it probably is when CCAs get separated. I don't know. Oh, another note that I should probably point out is sometimes I'm changing the wording just a little bit to make it easier to understand. Like when I'm say separation by disqualification, it actually just says separation hyphen disqualification. And it means the same thing. It's just easier to say. If you need the actual wording, of course, you should always look at these citations yourself, which is why I gave you the numbers. 365.325, procedure in separating. If an appointing official decides to terminate an employee who is serving a probationary period due to conditions arising prior to appointment or because work performance or conduct during this period fails to demonstrate qualification for continued postal employment, there again is another criteria, it's essentially the same criteria. The employee's services are terminated by notifying the employee in writing as to why he or she is being terminated and the effective date of the action. The written notice of termination must be at a minimum consist of the appointing official's conclusions about the inadequacies of performance or conduct. And I have heard tell of chicken shit supervisors at my station trying to get employees to simply resign. That an employee comes back late from a long day of delivering the mail, and there's a resignation form sitting at their case. And man, that is some chicken shit shit. All right, moving on. 365.326, effective date. The effective date of separation must be before the end of the probationary period and must not be retroactive. I'm sure management has tried to pull that crap before. You know, it's either 90 working days or 120 calendar days, whichever comes first. And if you are an employee who is on probation, it is important for you to keep track of how many days you've worked and when that 120 comes up. Whichever one comes first, boom, then you're in. After that, it's too late. 365.33, termination or separation of non-career employees. An employee serving under a temporary appointment may be separated at any time after notice in writing. In determining the proper action for a particular case, the following criteria are used. A. Termination, expiration of appointment is the term used to separate an employee who has reached the end of his or her term or whose services are no longer required. B. Separation is the term used when describing the discontinuance of the service of a non-career employee because of unsatisfactory performance that warrants termination from the Postal Service. And of course, there is another way to leave the Postal Service, and that is by death. So here are the provisions for that. 365.36, death. 365.36.1, proof of death. No action is taken to process the separation until credible evidence of death is received. Evidence of death is filed in the deceased employee's official personnel folder. This is going in your permanent record. The time and date of a postmaster's death Oh, okay. If it happens to be a postmaster who dies, then the time and date of a postmaster's death should be reported immediately to the vice president of area operations and the vice president of employee resource management. 365.362, effective date. Would you like to take a guess when the effective date of your termination by death is? Well, it turns out the effective date of separation is the date of the employee's death, the day that you actually die. Personnel action forms also show the last day that the employee was in a pay status. Man, if you were on vacation when you died, then you could be in a pay status even after your death. That's the way to do it, man. Go out on vacation. All right. 365.363, expression of condolence. The appropriate postal official should express condolences to the survivors, including a sincere expression of sympathy and an offer to assist in filing claims for any funds to the deceased employee's credit. All right. And then next we have a... So that's a nice thing, right? You get a nice sympathy card if you die while you're employed at the Postal Service. All right, and then the last thing... I pushed through all of this because I really want to get to this part, and it is Section 370, Performance Evaluation. 371, Introduction. Postal Service employees are expected to conduct themselves in a manner that reflects favorably upon the organization and perform their duties in the most efficient manner. Both the supervisor and employee have a material responsibility to achieve these goals. When properly used, performance evaluation strengthens the daily supervisor-employee relationship in working toward this end. 372, Sound Supervision. I'm going to tell you right now, these provisions that I'm about to read to you are going to go in some grievances about employees who talk shit to their employees, or supervisors who talk shit to their employees. All right. 372, sound supervision. The principles of sound supervision require that supervisors evaluate employee performance daily. Supervisors should counsel and instruct their employees as necessary, giving attention to evidence of good performance as well as to areas where the employees need improvement. So, a supervisor who says, hey, you need to go faster, that is not sound supervision. That is not counseling or instructing as necessary. That's just talking shit. That is not okay. They need to give you actual instructions. Hey, you should be doing this to try to improve your street time or whatever it is. 373, performance evaluation systems. 373.1, formal evaluation. Postal Service Headquarters prescribes formal evaluation systems for a variety of purposes. A formal evaluation consists of defined standards of performance, instructions for establishing a measure of when an employee fits within the standards, and a form to record information. So I might ask, if an employee is being disciplined for unsatisfactory performance, well, when was the last time you did a formal evaluation in accordance with 373.1? And then you have 373.2, informal evaluation. The informal evaluation is based on the supervisor's day-to-day observations and is characterized by the absence of forms and instructions. The supervisor should make use of available human resources and give personal encouragement and guidance as a part of his or her daily practice. These practices must be part of a continuous formal and informal process. So again, you need to go faster is not a valid form of personal encouragement. It is not guidance. And that's what the supervisor is supposed to be doing. So they need to be held to account for that. 374, discussing performance with employees. The supervisor must, there's that word, must discuss job performance with each employee. If the employee's performance is unsatisfactory, the supervisor suggests constructive measures for an employee to follow to improve his or her performance to a satisfactory level. This would be an interview question, right? If I'm going to interview management, what constructive measures did you suggest to this employee to improve his performance? Oh, I told him to go faster. I don't think that's going to qualify as a constructive measure. 375, outstanding and unsatisfactory performance. 375.1, outstanding performance. Outstanding performance is a level of performance that far exceeds that which is normally expected of an individual in a particular position and is far above the performance and achievement of most satisfactory employees in terms of productive effort, proficiency, and significant contributions to the Postal Service. If a supervisor determines that a bargaining employee's performance is outstanding, the supervisor considers recommending the employee for a special achievement award or a quality step increase. Yes, you heard that right, a quality step increase. And I know that's coming up in a future episode because I skipped ahead. Yeah, you can get a step increase for doing your job really well. Alright, for EAS employees, such performance is recognized, that's supervisors, for EAS employees, such performance is recognized in their annual merit review and recognition programs. See 416 and 490 for more information. So, yeah, if you're doing a really good job, you can get an award and you can even get your step increase based on such great performance. If any of you have ever heard of this happening, by all means, let me know, classesofmail@gmail.com, because as far as I know, this would be unprecedented. 375.2, unsatisfactory performance. Now, this one is used more regularly. Unsatisfactory performance is a level of performance that is repeatedly or consistently below the minimum requirements expected of an employee in the position. Based on an evaluation... Good thing I'm almost done. I'm going to start this one over. 375.2, unsatisfactory performance. Unsatisfactory performance is a level of performance that is repeatedly or consistently below the minimum requirements expected of an employee in the position, based on an evaluation of job-related factors, such as reliability, willingness to work with fellow employees, quantity or quality of work production, and attendance. If a supervisor determined that an employee's performance is unsatisfactory and reasonable efforts toward improving performance to a satisfactory level have not been successful, effort is made to reassign the employee to a job that the employee can be expected to perform satisfactorily. If there is no such job available and if disciplinary action must be taken, the appropriate adverse action procedure is followed. So, again, telling a CCA that you need to go faster is not a reasonable effort toward improving performance. And this will be another citation. As in ELM 375.2, what reasonable efforts did you make toward improving the employee's performance? So, that is all we're going to read today. That brings us into the 400s. The 400s are interesting in their own right, and they will be covered on a future episode. So, for now... thank you guys for listening. We are turning the tables on management, and there is more to come. Take care, guys. I'll catch you next time.